He sat up in his opened window, looking quietly down at the path. A firefly flew in his room and flew right out again. Down jumped the prince, and he went again to find his radio.
Network, this is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and you've tuned into the WGXC Morning Show with a busy morning show we have for you today. We will hear from Tim Kennedy, one of the master gardeners from the Green and Columbia County Cornell Cooperative Extension, and their Nature Calls audio show. We'll hear all about pollinators today and their role in the ecosystem on the WGXC Morning Show. Plus, we'll also hear the WGXC Congressional Report, mostly about the debt extension bill that passed last weekend in Congress. And we'll hear about a new report from the Sierra Club about the PFAS chemicals in sewage sludge that's being released locally and how the Sierra Club wants to change that. Plus, we'll hear the national headlines from the Public News Service and the local Better Weather from the Catskill Maker Syndicate. It all starts after the local news, which is next on the WGXC Morning Show. Stay tuned.
This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns to blood. This is the network. Network. And the moon turns to blood. A stream runs through. And the moon turns to blood. This is the network. Network. This is the news. This is the network. This is the news. This is the network. Network. This is the news.
This is Black Lake.
You're listening to
WGXC Accra,
Hudson, Catskill, New York.
You can find out about so many local events, like the traditional Irish music session. Every Sunday, there's an open Irish music jam at the Shamrock House in East Durham from 2 to 5 p.m. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org and add your own event to the WGXC community calendar and have it read on the radio at 90.7 FM by going to wgxc.org and clicking on the community calendar.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Peter McPartland of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Green and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Daily News for Monday, June 5th. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Steve Barnes reports for the Times Union that Vincent Bradley, the chair of the State Liquor Authority for 8 years, left the agency after it was announced on June 2nd. Three sources tell Barnes that he was forced out by Governor Kathy Hochul's office. Bradley was one of the few remaining top officials appointed by former Governor Andrew Cuomo. A spokesperson for the State Liquor Authority declined comment. The anonymous sources of Barnes also said that Lily M. Phan, a New York City attorney and Tony Award-winning theater producer, who is 1 year into her second four-year term as an SLA commissioner, would be named the new chair. Hochul's office did not reply to a request for comment, and Bradley and Phan also failed to respond to interview requests. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Diane Valden reports in the Upstater that Ankrum's Strategic Investment Committee recommended to the town board on May 18th that Ankrum invest $35,000 to help the local affordable housing problem. Strategic Investment Committee Chair Will Weiss said the money could be used by the town's housing committee to form a nonprofit housing trust, a legal entity. Weiss said there have been some research about the possibility of creating housing for volunteer firefighters that is strictly under the jurisdiction of fire districts. All board members voted in favor of the SIC recommendation for $35,000 to investigate the establishment of a housing trust. There were also discussions at the May 18th meeting about private donations to help the housing issue and the work of the Rojan Housing Task Force and Habitat for Humanity. Read more about this story in the Upstater. Nick Reisman reports at New York State of Politics that tobacco usage among middle and high school students in New York is dropping, with less vaping and e-cigarette usage in recent years after a ban on flavored vaping products. That news comes from a new report released this week by the State Department of Health. Also, the New York Youth Tobacco Survey recently found that e-cigarette usage declined 32% from 27.4% of students in 2018 to 18.7% in 2022. And an annual telephone survey of adult New Yorkers found smoking dropped from 14.1% to 12% between 2017 and 2021. Last month, legislators and the governor agreed to raise New York's cigarette tax by $1 as part of the $229 billion state budget. Dr. Jennifer Lee, the director of the Bureau of Tobacco Control, said, quote, "We have the highest and strongest tobacco tax in the country, and we are able to really understand that will have a big impact," unquote. Read more about this story at New York State of Politics. And Steve Barnes reports in the Times Union that the Mexican radio restaurant in Schenectady has closed after 9 years. The restaurant started in New York City, but also had a Hudson location for 16 years that closed in August 2019. Now all three locations are closed, and there is no tuning in Mexican radio in New York. Read more about this story in the Times Union, and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
Hello and welcome to the better weather for Monday, June 5th. We are 42.7% of the way through the year. There are 16 days left until official summer. Local early morning temperatures range from 39 degrees in Steventown to 53 in Voorheesville. Regional average soil temperature is 60 degrees. Pollen levels for today will be high-ish. It is up there, but not at peak, and there is a chance it dips to medium this week. Today, we'll have a cool morning and a comfortable afternoon. Partly cloudy skies with some stiff winds and a high of 75 degrees at 4 p.m. Overnight, temperatures dip to 52 degrees. And it sees the start of some rain for some. That precip gets stronger tomorrow afternoon and brings thunder chances along with it. A high of 73 happens at 1 p.m. Overnight, cools to 48 degrees. Then, Wednesday, still cloudy with a chance of rain in the afternoon. We see a high of 70 degrees. Thursday, same deal. Cool, cloudy, maybe rain. Today's tide schedule is high tide at 4:07 a.m., low tide at 11:20 a.m., high tide at 4:46 p.m., and low tide, once again, at 11:16 p.m. Today's river temperature will be 70.5 degrees and the tide strength will be high. Sunset today will be at 8:12 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow will be at 5:17 a.m. Looking way up, we see yesterday a coronal mass ejection was caught leaving the sun and could be on its way to our little rock on Wednesday. X-class flare chances are at 10%. Plasma winds will be average at 442 kilometers per second with an average density of 8 protons per cubic centimeter. Radio propagation conditions are currently fair below 4 megahertz with fair conditions across the board overnight. The 24-hour predicted KP index is 4. Unsettled. The current sunspot number is 110. And this has been the Better Weather, brought to you by the Catskill Makers Syndicate.
And then I just, there's good news. Good evening. I'm
There are so many events on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org. You can find out things to do in person and virtually on the WGXC community calendar, like the Hudson Area Libraries Anime Club meets at 3:30 p.m. on Tuesday, June 6th. Tuesday, June 6th at 6:30 p.m., the Catskill Town Board meets, and you can attend that in person at the Catskill Town Hall, 439 Main Street in Catskill. Or you can attend it online. WGXC has a live web stream of the Catskill Town Board meetings, and you can tune in at wgxc.org/listen or at the townofcatskillny.gov. That's Tuesday, June 6th at 6:30 p.m. On Wednesday, June 7th at the Dewey Hall in Massachusetts, there is poetry from Francis Roth and Sarah Thames. Thursday, June 8th, the Hudson Thursday Market is back in the public square on 7th Street between Columbia and Warren Street with all sorts of vendors. That's from 4 to 7 p.m. Also Thursday, June 8th at 4 p.m., local musician Abby Lappin teaches movement and music at Storytime, the Hudson Area Library. Friday, June 9th, there's a community spaghetti dinner at the American Legion in Greenville from 4:30 to 7 p.m. It's eat in or take out there. There's a community care clinic at the Hudson Area Library at 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday, June 10th, with information about acupuncture, herbal medicines, Narcan strips, and more. Sunday, June 11th, there's a history of Lionel trains at the Mountaintop Historical Society in Palinville, and the traditional Irish music session is at the Shamrock House in East Durham, Sunday, June 11th from 2 to 5 p.m. Find out more about all these events and add your own at the WGXC community calendar at wgxc.org.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Passing this budget agreement was critical. The stakes could not have been higher. If we had failed to reach an agreement on the budget, there were extreme voices threatening to take America for the first time in our 247-year history into default.
With only 2 days to spare, President Joe Biden signed the bipartisan bill lifting the nation's debt ceiling, avoiding a possibly catastrophic default on federal obligations. Utah Senator and conservative Republican Mike Lee was not enthusiastic about the deal Biden reached with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Lee said it wasn't a victory and said both sides have yet to engage in actual compromises. With the debt negotiations no longer at center stage, White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says Biden wants Congress to move on to other issues. She cited an ambitious list: expanding civil rights protections on the basis of sexual and gender orientation, comprehensive immigration reform, and easing permitting for some energy projects.
So the president has a serious agenda that he wants to get done for the American people, and he's going to continue to work on that agenda. And not only that, his agenda is actually popular with majority of Americans.
Several Republican presidential hopefuls spoke in Des Moines, Iowa over the weekend. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley said she feels students should only participate in sports according to the gender they were born with.
And let me tell you something. The idea that we have biological boys playing in girls' sports is the biggest women's issue of our time, and we should be fighting that every day.
Former Vice President Mike Pence said he might officially announce his candidacy this week.
And I don't have anything to announce today, but I can tell you, when I got time to announce come this Wednesday, I'm announcing in Iowa.
While Pence has distanced himself from former President Donald Trump, he's also campaigning on what he calls the accomplishments of Trump's administration. The Justice Department lifted a cloud over the former vice president Friday, closing an investigation into Pence's handling of the classified documents without bringing charges. Former Trump attorney Timothy Parlatore said he would not be surprised if the former president also did not face any classified document charges, because bringing charges could end up revealing national security secrets. A federal judge has ruled unconstitutional a Tennessee law banning drag shows where children could view them, saying it violated free speech. Democratic State Representative Justin Jones wished everyone happy Pride Month on Twitter and says the law was so out of line that it was overturned by a judge appointed by Trump.
You may not agree with going to drag shows. No one's forcing you to go. But don't try and erase a whole identity of people because of hatred and bigotry in your heart.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government buy-in for the people. We're in North Carolina today, awaiting action by the U.S. Supreme Court on Moore versus Harper, the independent state legislature theory test case. And we just learned about a new bill shortening mail-in ballot deadlines and implementing provisional ballots for Election Day registrants. A ruling from the High Court is expected this week or next on Moore versus Harper, the fringe constitutional theory that state legislatures have ultimate power over election law, even over gubernatorial vetoes and court decisions. New anti-democracy legislation has also been filed in North Carolina using boilerplate bills drafted by a group that Raleigh's WRAL reports is run by Cleta Mitchell, head of former President Trump's legal team attempting to overturn the results of the 2020 election. The proposed legislation requires receipt of mail-in ballots by 7:30 p.m. election day rather than the third day after, and implements two-factor identification for mail ballots. It would allow challenges to voter eligibility by other precinct voters, a voter suppression tactic and burden for election workers. The bill also requires voters registering on election day to use a provisional ballot and not count it until the voter's address is verified by mail or additional documents are provided. Despite little or no evidence of fraud, politicians backing such voter suppression legislation claim it allays public doubt about elections, doubt of their own making. We have more at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
Hi, I'm Tim Kenalty.
And I'm Jean Thomas.
And welcome to another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. Who's our guest today, Jean?
Today our guest is Tim.
Ah, me. I'm the guest. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. What am I talking about?
We're talking to Tim about pollinators.
Yeah, pollinators. This is one of my favorite topics because there's so much you can do to support pollinators. And when we say pollinators, we're generally talking about bees and wasps and butterflies and moths. Pollinators are incredibly important to our ecosystems, but also important to our food supply. I mean, so it's not just about looking at the pretty butterflies out there. It's really talking about supporting our food supply as well.
What else are you going to cover, Tim?
Well, I'm going to talk about the difference between bees and wasps, mm-hmm. and I'm going to talk about all the different plants. In fact, you need to plant two different types of plants to support butterflies and moths.
So you're going to talk about pretty stuff, too.
Pretty stuff, exactly. Okay. I hope that you're going to be listening to that one, Jean.
I'll try.
Okay.
I'm going to listen to Teresa.
Of course you're going to listen to Teresa. Teresa's great, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what is she talking about today on the veggie patch?
She's back in the veggie patch, and she's starting veggies from seed.
You know, this is going to be a good one because I have never been able to do this. I think it's really challenging to start them from seed. She's going to talk about all the preparation that you need to do and different types of veggies that you can grow directly in your garden from seed and those that you have to start ahead of time.
And the reasons that it's worth doing the different work.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely. And Linda is going to be back with Hum of the Hive, right?
That always makes me smile.
It makes me smile. It makes me smile a lot. And she's talking about field bees.
And who knew? Field bees are the pinnacle of achievement for a bee.
Yeah, the most mature bees go out in the field, and they collect water and pollen and resin and nectar. They're really important.
And I have to ask Linda one day, they're like tiny little pilots, aren't they? You think they get their wings with little ceremonies?
Well, not are they pilots, but they're also dancers, according to Linda, right?
Yes.
When they find really good pollen and nectar, they come back and do a waggle dance. She's going to talk all about that. I can't wait. It's the best. It's really, really a cool episode.
And we should go sit down somewhere and listen.
Or waggle.
We'll go waggle somewhere. Hello, everyone. Today's conversation from the Hudson Valley is with Tim Kenalty. Tim is usually my co-host, but I refuse to let him talk to himself on the air. So it's just the two of us. And Teresa may be popping in a question or two. I'm asking the questions. He's providing the answers. The topic is pollinators. Tim, why don't you tell us how you got interested in pollinators?
Well, first, Jean, thanks for keeping me company. I really appreciate it. I don't like talking to myself. I really appreciate the opportunity to introduce myself today. I am a gardener for 30 years in the Hudson Valley in the town of Taconic. I garden on about 13 acres with about an acre of plants. And I come from a family of gardeners. My parents were gardeners. My grandfather had a big vegetable garden, so it's really probably, like a lot of our listeners, in the blood. And I was also one of these kids who ran around chasing butterflies and catching frogs and things like that. And about 10 years ago in my garden, and after I had taken a course on native plants, it kind of hit me that the plants really have a huge effect on really supporting the insects and the birds out there. And I took more and more courses, and you'll probably find in future podcasts, I'm really passionate about native plants and pollinators.
Okay, so where shall we start? How about a definition of a pollinator?
Pollination is a really important part of sexual reproduction in plants. The pollinators are animals that are essentially taking the pollen grain, which is the male sex cell, from one flower to another. And when that happens, there's fertilization, and the outcome are seeds and fruit. And pollination, I think a lot of people think of pollinators as, you know, these cute little bees in their garden, but pollination is incredibly important. The Xerces Society, which is a group that supports pollinators, has come out with some data, and they basically say that 1 in 3 bites of food or drink are the result of pollination, and 75% of plants on Earth need animals to pollinate them. So it's really key to our survival. It's a really, really important thing.
So you mentioned bees, but aren't there other different types of pollinators as well?
There are. Bats and birds are thought of as pollinators, but really the pollinators, when we're talking about pollinators, we're talking about insects, and we're talking about 4 main groups of insects. We're talking about bees and wasps, butterflies and moths, beetles, and flies. And when we're really talking about pollinator gardens, we're really talking about bees and wasps and butterflies and moths and how we support them.
Okay, so we've got flowers and we've got insects and a nice little cooperation going on between them. What do we do about climate change and how the threat of habitat loss kicks in?
Yeah, habitat loss and degradation and habitat fragmentation are really detrimental to our pollinators. In fact, studies show that 40% of our insects are on the decline, and climate change is really disrupting plant communities and causing geographic shifts that pollinators really, when they sync up with those plants, those flowering plants and that fruit, they're really, the syncing is not working anymore. So it's really serious stuff. And a lot of times, you know, when you start reading about these things, climate change and habitat loss, it can be really overwhelming. What I like to tell gardeners is, and gardeners are, of course, the coolest people on Earth, right? What I like to tell gardeners is they really can make a difference in how you think about your property, how you think about what you're planting and what you're not planting. They in the world, especially cumulatively, can make a difference. And how many times can we say that about things that you do in your world?
Okay, we've reviewed some of the big picture issues. Now let's start with some particular pollinators. Let's start with bees. I know my garden's happy when it's humming. Is it mostly honeybees we should be encouraging? I hear a lot about how much commercial agriculture depends on them. Is it the same with nature preserves? And how about our home gardens?
Yeah, honeybees are incredibly important pollinators. You probably know that they were imported from Europe, and they're incredibly efficient because they are social, so they have hives, and there's many, many bees involved to go out and pollinate, and they're also portable, so a farmer can take a hive from one, say, orchard to another. So they're incredibly important in pollination. But there are native bees, too. We have a lot of native bees out there, too, that are great pollinators.
So if the honeybees all went away, would the other bees step up or fly up?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. We really are losing honeybees out there in large numbers. And as I said, the native bees are important pollinators, but we really don't want to lose either of them. As I said, pollination is an incredibly important part of, you know, our agriculture. So all of them are important. And what we do in our garden really is advantageous to both of them.
So how many different species of native bees are there?
It's pretty mind-blowing. In North America, there's 4,000 species of native bees. In our area, there's probably 300 or 400, something like that.
So now at one time you mentioned the farmscape ecology. What's that about?
Yeah, farmscape ecology is this wonderful organization in Columbia County that does a lot of work in studying bees and butterflies and other kinds of animals as well. And their website's really terrific.
When you're talking about bees, do they all live together in hives?
Yeah, that's kind of a common misconception. When people think of bees, they usually think of honeybees that are social. But our native bees actually about 90% of them are solitary, which means there's a single male and a single female. They go off and mate, and then the female, usually the male dies then, and the female lays eggs, and the cycle begins again. So not many of them are social. Bumblebees, which are native bees, are social, but the rest of them pretty much aren't. And a lot of people think of the, you know, that they have a, that all the bees are social and they have a hive and that you see it up there in the tree, but generally about 70% of native bees nest in the ground. And most of the rest of them are nesting in kind of plant stems and things like that. So really not what most people think about native bees.
Are all these native bees pollinators?
Yes, any bee that's out there is consuming pollen and consuming nectar. They're out there doing that. And when they do that, they're kind of physiologically designed to carry that pollen. So they've got these hairy legs, and they go from one flower to another, and they inadvertently take pollen from one flower to another. So they're all good pollinators, yeah.
Do native bees go after different types of plants than honeybees?
Yeah, that's a great question, Teresa. Not that Jean hasn't had good questions, but that's a great question. Because of coevolution, and that's really the kind of important thing here. Those native bees have co-evolved with different flowers out there, and so their body parts have co-evolved. So there are long-tongued bees and short-tongued bees, and they're going to be, they've co-evolved to pollinate particular flowers and to eat nectar from particular flowers. It's really kind of fascinating when you start looking into it.
Next, we have an interview from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
I'm joined today by Wayne Miller, who is a retired librarian, but also active with the Sierra Club. And the Sierra Club recently issued a report, actually on Thursday, saying that New York should stop allowing the land spreading of sewer sludge that may contain hazardous chemicals. So Wayne, why did the Sierra Club decide to issue this report?
Well, it was a project of the Food and Farm Committee of the Atlantic Chapter, which is the New York State level. As we looked at dangers to the food supply and water, and more evidence was coming out about 2 years ago about PFAS being in sewage sludge. So I got personally involved because I live in Franklin County, where Freedom of Information requests yielded the fact that about 500,000 tons of wet sewer sludge from outside of the county and outside of the state and outside of the country have come to my county, Franklin County, up on the Canadian border in the past decade and been minimally processed and then put onto farm fields. So this is alarming, and it was alarming to the people in New York City who are on the committee and several people spread through the Finger Lakes and in the capital region. So four of us took it upon ourselves to compile this report.
Now, you mentioned, PFAS, one of the forever chemicals, and certainly here in the Capital District, that's been in the news, most initially with the tremendous problem out in Hoosick Falls, but also even in my hometown of Postenkill, and the Pentagon was burning PFAS at the Cohoes hazardous waste Norlite incinerator. But I was involved 30 years ago in fighting what they call a mixed waste co-composting facility out in eastern Rensselaer County. Henry's Wack became county executive. And they were going to take the sewer sludge from the town of Hoosick, village of Hoosick Falls. And I said, wait a moment, guys, there's going to be a lot of heavy metals and other contaminants. So this report particularly looked at the PFAS forever chemicals. Were there other contaminants that you were finding in sewer sludge?
Well, we do not have the capacity ourselves to test sewer sludge, but through freedom of information, we have obtained what DEC testing has revealed in sewer sludge, which is only for a handful of waste water treatment plants in New York State, but all of them showed very high levels of PFAS. And I just want to mention that PFAS is an overall term for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances. These are basically carbon chains with a couple of fluoride molecules attached to it that were invented in the 30s and came into commercial use in the 40s. So it's Teflon, it's Scotchgard, and PFOA and PFOS, which were the two originals, have now been, because they were proven to be harmful to human health, chemical companies have invented new ones, and there are estimates of as many as 15,000 of these in production right now. So, no, we do not have the direct numbers for what are in sewer sludge. I do know that the Casella operation in my county, that is the one that is processing and distributing this sewer sludge to be applied to agricultural lands, does report to DEC that the heavy metal contents of about a dozen, I believe, I've obtained one of their annual reports to DEC that does show that they say, well, we have less than a certain amount. Now, we're talking heavy metals and PFAS and all these things which accumulate. One of our co-authors, she likens it to DEC's standards to setting the speed limit at 300 miles an hour.
Well, as you know, my wife used to work for EPA, and so she's been quite active with the you know, PFOA issue, and I remember when she started, you know, the fight in Hoosick Falls, I don't know, 7-8 years ago, I think the initial target level was 7, I think, parts per million, and then the state dropped it to 10. And now EPA just recently came out and said, you know, there's really no levels of these forever chemicals that are safe for human consumption. So why is DEC, you know, how is DEC reacting to this? I mean, my understanding is DEC kind of promotes farmers using septic sludge. Aren't they concerned about, you know, some of these environmental and public health safety issues?
Well, you would think, but they're dealing with the problem of what to do with the sewer sludge. Insufficient number of landfills, other states around us closing landfills and sending stuff to New York. And so in the climate action plan that right now is in a comment period until June 14th, although we're asking that they extend that comment period, calls for more than doubling the amount of sewer sludge that's spread on farmlands, on lands, over the next couple of decades. So instead of pulling back on this, they're increasing it drastically.
Now, one of the things I noticed from the report was that Maine has banned the lead spread in the sewer sludge, particularly because they found high levels of PFAS and other things. I understand you have a number of recommendations for both the state legislature and DEC. Can you maybe quickly summarize them?
Well, yes. Basically, we're asking for DEC to, for the legislature to direct DEC to stop the spreading of sewage sludge in any form on fields and farms and to end the production, sale, and distribution of soil amendments, including compost, because a lot of these wastewater treatment plants are composting and then selling this or giving it to gardeners as a organic soil amendment. The New York legislature, we want the New York legislature to ban wastewater treatment plants from accepting landfill leachate, which is highly, highly contaminated, to strengthen drinking water standards. You mentioned that the EPA's current drinking water standards and is that for PFOA, it should be less than 0.004 parts per trillion, and for PFOS, 0.02 parts per trillion. The New York Department of Health drinking water standards that were issued last year call for 10 parts per trillion, so several orders of magnitude higher than the EPA advisory. So we would like the DOH to strengthen the drinking water standards. We want DEC to test the soil on lands where sewage sludge has been spread. And all of these tests, we want them to submit these tests to the EPA, which maintains a really wonderful database of all of this kind of data. But New York State does not participate, and DEC is something less than transparent about making the data that they do collect available. We also want the legislature to create a fund to compensate farmers who may have had sewage sludge spread on their land unknowing that PFOA contamination was coming along with the low-cost nutrient load that the biosolids are bringing. And lastly, I would mention that we want the legislature to devise a system where the polluting company is held financially responsible for the harms created by the spreading of sewage sludge.
So we only have about 30 seconds left. We've been talking with Wayne Miller with the Sierra Club. Wayne, if people want to see the copy of the report, find out more information, I assume it's on Sierra Club website someplace?
Yes, if you Google Atlantic Chapter Sierra Club, everything is right there on the front page of that, prominently displayed.
Thank you very much. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That interview was from
WOOC.
To learn more about this program, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Thank you.
From the WGXC newsroom, this is the WGXC News Update. Adro Snyder reports in the Times Union that tender dry conditions and the fluffy white seeds of cottonwood and poplar seeds are creating wildfires in the Hudson Valley. On June 1st, there were still wildfires in Gilderton, Rotterdam, and Schenectady, accelerated by the cottonwood and poplar seeds that have blanketed the ground. John Keimer, public information officer for the Westmere Fire Department, said, and I quote, "If it ignites this snow-like material, it takes off. It's like gasoline," end quote. Little to no precipitation has fallen locally for the past 10 to 14 days, according to Brett Rathbun, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Albany. Rathburn said, and I quote, "With the combination of it being that warm and that dry for so long, any little ignition source could call for some brush fires," end quote. Rotterdam, for instance, declared a water emergency this week with a ban on all outdoor water use through the weekend. Cooler temperatures and rain are forecast locally, and John Keimer, public information officer for the Westmere Fire Department, said, and I quote, "Hopefully brush season will end shortly," end quote. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that Governor Kathy Hochul announced on June 2nd that 24 land banks across New York will receive nearly $26 million in funding to expand housing in the state. Hochul said, and I quote, "New York's land bank initiative has already allowed us to preserve, restore, and revitalize rundown properties across the state, and we are excited to be extending the opportunity this year. This program will empower local nonprofits, the people that know their communities best, to help increase home ownership while repairing the fabric of their neighborhoods," end quote. Hochul had wanted to expand affordable housing throughout New York in the state budget with a plan to add 800,000 units over the next 10 years that was shot down by the legislature. Officials are hoping the money for the land bank plan will help create or preserve 100,000 affordable homes in New York. Read more about this story in New York State of Politics. Mid-Hudson News reports that Ulster County-based Assemblyperson Sarah Hannah Streshta has introduced legislation aimed at Central Hudson to strengthen accountability measures against alleged wrongdoings by utilities. The Democrat Socialist from his office wants consumer utility protections during investigations that would prohibit gas, electric, telecommunications, and water companies from charging late fees or terminating service when the utility is being investigated by the State Public Service Commission. Sresta said, and I quote, "It should not be up to them to decide when to suspend late fees when they are being investigated. We want to make sure this is guaranteed, and we also want to make sure that this is clearly communicated to the customers," end quote. Sresta says with the legislature soon winding down that the bills won't be taken up until January. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. And that wraps up the WGXC News Update. You can visit our website at WGXC.org for local weather updates, public meetings, a community calendar, or COVID-19 updates. And while you're there, please click on the donate button to become a WGXC sustaining supporter or make a one-time donation. From the WGXC Newsroom, I'm Philip Grant. Have a good day and a nice weekend.
In spite of looks of disgust and hateful online comments, a New York chef is persevering on his mission to change minds about eating insects. Chef Joseph Yoon founded Brooklyn Bugs and is hoping to change public perception on palatable pests. The entomophagy expert's mission isn't an easy one, although its success can be beneficial in the battle against climate change. A United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization report finds edible insects create far less emissions than conventional livestock. Yoon notes this is particularly true of the multi-purpose black soldier fly.
They can eliminate organic waste, and their larvae grow thousands of times in, like, I believe, like a 2-week time span. And the organic waste that they eat can, while they do that, they emit a negligible amount of methane gases.
He says their larvae can also be used as pet food or livestock feed, with the fly's excrement being used as fertilizer. According to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, agriculture was the lowest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions in 2021. It accounted for 10% of emissions that year, while transportation, electric power, and industry were the top emitters. Indigenous people across the globe have historically eaten insects. A 2021 National Library of Medicine survey finds 8 insect species were used as food among South Africa's Limpopo or KwaZulu-Natal provinces. But in the U.S., opposition to edible insects centers on the notion that it's infringing on the livelihoods of conventional farmers. Yoon says that's not the goal, adding, there's room for all sources of equally nutritious proteins on our plates.
And so it's like, okay, if we can eat something just once in a while and like maybe skip the burger or steak one day of the week and substitute it, then amazing. And I think that there's a lot of room, and it's not an either or proposition. I think it's more of an and proposition.
Entomophagy is growing in size, a trend that's expected to continue in the coming years. A 2022 Research and Markets report finds the edible insect market was valued at $822 million in 2020. This is expected to grow by 23%, reaching a market size of $3.6 billion in 2027. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, New York News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org. This story was produced with original reporting from Whitney Bauck for The Guardian.
The National Weather Service in Albany says cool conditions will persist over the next several days, with an upper-level low in place over the region. It'll be mainly dry on Monday, but then there's a chance of rain on Tuesday. Mostly sunny is the forecast Monday, with a high of 70 and a north wind 10 to 13 miles per hour spinning local windmills. Monday night, there's a 20% chance of showers after 1 a.m. with a low around 52. And then Tuesday, there's a 70% chance of rain, showers before 11 a.m., possibly a thunderstorm in the afternoon. Otherwise, it'll be partly sunny with a high of 69 and a northwest wind 8 to 13 miles per hour spinning those windmills. Tuesday night, there's a 60% chance of showers, possibly a thunderstorm before 8 p.m. Cloudy skies and a low around 50 is forecast. Wednesday, there's a 50% chance of showers. Otherwise, it'll be partly sunny with a high of 66 and a low around 48. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ears.
Search of a story that's never been known.